am. You may kiss my ring. And inside is this scrawny little thing, just filled with pomp. I love pomp. I love pompous people. They are one of the few people I can pick on without any guilt whatsoever. You ain't pompous. You don't have what it takes to be pompous.
I thought that's
where
you were getting at.
No. Pompous you're not. We have some other things we will talk about later. He's also a good dad. Do you notice that? This baby's sleeping next to this drunk, for God's sake. This ne'er-do-well. This, oh, my. Anybody else here been pompous?
Yes.
The worst place we display that is at home. In the criminal act called raising children. That's usually a criminal activity, the way most of us did it. Forcing my kingdom upon yours. You will do what I say. You will be what I want you to be. You will behave this way. You are a reflection of me. Blah, 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 blah. It's a criminal act. So we don't do that here anymore. Neither with the people I sponsor, nor with my children and grandchildren. Okay. Did you enjoy being pompous? That's pompous. Dismissal of you as a person. I disagree with you, but I don't have any way to counter your argument, so. In today's world, it says, whatever. Uh-oh, somebody said that just not too long ago, didn't they? Whatever. It just stops everything. Yeah. And by worship of other things. Oh, my God. Money, power, cars, sex, work, worship. One of the funniest things I have ever seen was somebody who understood this, an Al-Anon member, who played it out on the floor where I worked. I worked for an organization that got jobs for the men coming out of prison. We did job counseling, setting things up, training, all that sort of stuff. So there'd be 8 or 10 of them sitting on a bench in the morning. And this little Al-Anon named Paula, She was cute and vivacious and bouncy and irreverent and nearly pornographic in every move. It was just Paula in her natural state. And the boys would sit there and watch and just wonder. And we had an older Mexican counselor named Mercy Medina. And Mercy and Paula really genuinely liked each other. And Mercy had a sense of humor. And one morning when all the boys were sitting there, Mercy ran out and kneeled in front of Paula and said, "Thank you, Jesus, thank you." And she put her hand on his head and said, "Mercy, honey, I'd make a cripple out of you." Playing pompous is a game, because that's what it is. It's a game. Yeah. Have some fun with all this. But those get in the way of my relationship with God. Can't tolerate pomposity. Can't tolerate worship of other things. And it isn't that there's a rule against it, but if I'm worshiping money, I can't worship the Spirit. You can't serve two masters. That sounds like a rule. That's simply a statement of fact. You can't serve two masters. This whole deal is about all or nothing. And this is what was given to me, thank God. They didn't pussyfoot with me. It's all or nothing. We finally saw the faith in some kind of a God as a part of our makeup as much as the feeling we have for a friend. What do you think of that? Just as a general idea. Have you ever worshipped anything?
Yeah.
tattoos. Yeah. They are demonstrations of who I am or how I think. Yeah. These are my signs. I worship this to the point where I make a mark on me to let you know. This is simple. Good God, I've been bit by something. Where is it? I'll bite him back. This is me. It says Don. Isn't that funny? At 17, I was already getting to the place where I had to put my name on my arm so I wouldn't forget it. But you understand it. Worship of some sort. Yeah. You went, uh-huh. What was yours?
I worship my daughter.
Okay. How does that play out? Would you give your life for her?
Definitely.
Yeah. We make a mistake with that one sometimes, you know. Greater love hath no man than to give his life for his brother. I used to think that meant I'd be willing to die for you, which is only one aspect of it. The real truth of that one is, I will give my life for you. I will do my living for you. That's what this is about. I will live my life as if it were your last day. Not as if it were my last day. Yeah. It's quite a change. So you'd kind of like to stop drinking then, wouldn't you? Does that interfere with your worship of your daughter?
It would, yeah.
Okay.
I've been sober since she's been born.
That's good. How long has that been?
2 years next week.
Hallelujah. Look at that. Somebody told me he was new. He isn't new. He's an old timer. No, that's good. How about you? Have you worshipped anything along the way? Michigan.
Drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
Not anymore, but that was my main concern for a long time.
Did you ever pray at the tube when the Wolverines were playing?
Yeah, a few times.
Okay. No, these... It isn't as silly as it sounds. Those are whatever occupies my attention, whatever gives me the power, that is my God. That's what I'm worshiping. And we all go through that. That stands in the way. I can only serve one master. Yeah. This is a bitch. This calls for some serious thought, doesn't it? I thought this was going to be easy. Come in, don't drink. Go to meetings. Oh. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep within. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. What a scary thing to present to somebody like me who had gone deep within, and what he found, he had to kill it. Thank God for the people who understand it. Like Bruce said, there's nothing in there that hasn't already killed you. And if we go in and face it and shine the light on it, it will go away. What a great promise. But God can't stand a vacuum, so as I open up, it will fill me up. If I get rid of who I'm not, then I'll become who I am. It's automatic. I don't even have to look anymore. Is that an acceptable idea? That this is deep within? It means casting out most of our old ideas. Most of us have been taught it's out here somewhere. Some nebulous place called heaven or whatever. Or it doesn't exist at all. Or if it does, I don't want anything to do with it. This casts all those ideas out. If I'm going to go deep within, would you like to try that journey? I mean, it's a little rigorous journey. It takes several weeks. You can awaken immediately, but the journey to the quiet place takes a little bit of time because you got a lot of sludge to clear out of the way. So, okay. Well, I've taken the journey before. I like it. I like to go back down to the beginning of the road and pick some guy up and bring him along with me and make the journey all over again. The journey is most of the fun. isn't it, Jack?
Yes, sir.
It's the journey. I thought the spiritual awakening meant it's over now. This is the end of the road. My favorite gospel, and I love gospel music. Oh, I didn't know that, but I love to sing those old gospel songs. Old Mahalia Jackson sang one that epitomizes my sense of my spirituality. Rusty old halo, skinny white cloud, or skinny white wings, and a robe that's so itchy it scratches. A rusty old halo, a skinny old cloud, secondhand wings full of patches. And that's kind of it. Okay. No more pomp, no more ermine. Just a skinny white cloud and a robe that's so woolly it scratches. Any of you ever hear Mahalia Jackson sing? If you ever have the opportunity, just listen. She was the voice of God. It came right through her. She did to music what Jack does to wood. She carved away everything that didn't belong in a song and then sang whatever was left with power and gusto. Oh, my. So that's where we're going to go looking. As Bruce said, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. How it works is an important chapter that we read so often we've forgotten how important it is. Its meaning gets lost. It is the approach to the program. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. It's not a judgment, it's an observation. People who don't recover simply don't use the recovery process. That's simple. These are usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Do any of you think that? That you're constitutionally incapable of being honest with yourselves? Do you still think that? Yeah. I used to think that. I went to Phil and told him that. He says, well, that's the most honest statement you've ever made, so you're capable. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Jesus had a lot of manes on what is rigorous honesty. What's so funny? We either spend our meeting time talking about things we don't know anything about, or we dissect things that are very simple. Rigorous honesty means rigorous honesty. Okay. What does that mean? Rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. I am one of those. Grave emotional and mental disorders to the point where competent authorities properly diagnosed me. A psychopath is a person that doesn't know the difference between right and wrong, so you can't help them. A sociopath is a person who does know the difference between right and wrong. They just don't give a damn. So you can't help them. And I was that second. A type 2, whatever that means. I don't know what a type 1 is, but I don't need it. Grave emotional and mental disorders. But they recover if they have a capacity to be honest. Have you conceded to your innermost self yet that you are alcoholic? That's as rigorously honest as you need to get to begin the path. That's the first step in recovery. to concede to my innermost self that I am indeed alcoholic. And that being the case, there is no treatment for it. I am doomed to either live a miserable life or drink myself to death without spiritual aid. That's the deal. Is that okay with you? Good. Well, he just sent you an angel. He sent me three of them. They were ugly, except for Bruce. Then I'm told how to present myself. Again, I'm being taught. Our story is disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Now, that's pretty clear. Sometimes I hear people talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and it confuses me a little bit because it isn't the definition. The drama is a good backdrop for what it is. What was I like? What happened, and what am I like now? And for me, and this is not a, please not a condemnation, but you asked me to share my life with you. I would never, ever think of taking a personal problem to an AA meeting. I can't think of anything sillier for me to do. I go in with a problem. And there's 20 of you here. I leave with 21 problems. Now what am I going to do? There are people that we sometimes call sponsors or advisors, they get that. Because they will show me a solution. They won't try to give me an answer. They'll show me a solution, which is always the same. Have you prayed about it yet? Jesus, why do I call him? What I do take to meetings is what I was like when I had the problem. What happened to me and what I'm like now that I don't have the problem. Because there may be somebody there with that problem. And it takes all three. If all I came to AA and heard were war stories, why would I stay here? I know all about that. I mean, I think they're amusing and I think they're vitally important for identification. But there better be more than that. I want to know what happened to you. How come it is you don't drink anymore? And Bruce and Phil and Roy would tell me that. And now what are you like? I've changed. What am I like today? Well, you've been with me over the weekend, part of the time. I'm a mouthy, opinionated old man. If you want to take that view, Brian thinks I'm cute. But Brian is very astute. So it goes far beyond that. Fact number one is that I have been continuously sober, alcohol-free, for a little over 35 years. That's part of who I am. New people need to know that. You may not want what I have, but you may want that, and that's a possibility. I am living hope, and so are you. We could have worked him over on the street. Wouldn't be the first time. More better, we thought, let's bring him here among all of us. Maybe he can gather hope just from seeing the numbers of people living this way that are laughing and eating and having fun and really getting something out of life. Let me offer you something here. This book, I get tickled with this. Bill and Dr. Bob used to sit down at the kitchen table with some of the boys and count noses because most alcoholics don't make it. And after about 3 years, they were counting noses one night and realized they had 40 people doing essentially the same thing. They were staying sober for long periods of time, like 6 months and 7 months. And some of them even 2 and 3 years. This is a big deal. It doesn't happen. We better write a book about that. By the time they got it done, there were about 100, roughly. I have heard people say, well, there were only 77, but Bill liked even numbers. Whatever the hell the truth is, doesn't matter. The fact is, there are more people in this room today than were in all of Alcoholics Anonymous the night they decided they better write this book. Is that powerful? Just knocks me for a loop. Yeah. What a deal. And both of them died sober, by the way. If you decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. We had hundreds of meetings on, particularly midnight meetings at York Street, on what does any lengths mean? It means any lengths. What we spent meetings talking about that was important is what possible lengths are there that we wouldn't go to. But it just means any lengths, whatever. You want me to push peanuts down Broadway with my nose? If that'll keep me sober, I'll do it. But you're going to have to convince me that'll keep me sober because I don't humiliate myself before anybody. I'm one of God's kids. But I'm willing. If you can show me a good reason to do it, I'll do it. If it'll make my granddaughter laugh, I'll do it in a flash. Oh, please protect me from the 5-year-old. She could get me to do anything. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness that I command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Nil means nothing. You get no results at all by holding on to anything. Have you noticed that with new people? One of the ways that gets displayed that sponsors need to watch for is suddenly around the 4th step, you don't hear from them anymore. And then 6 months later, they come back for the second time and wonder why it didn't work. Now, I used to start them at the beginning and go through, assuming we missed something. The last two I've had that did that, I won't let them do that. They were in the middle of inventory, finish it. We're not going to do a 1-2-3 dance for the next 10 years. Finish this. And when we finish the whole process, if you need to, we'll go back and do the whole thing again. I haven't heard from either one of them. They don't like that idea. They want somebody to do the dance with them. One of them called me, and this sounds cold and hard, but I think it's loving. Well, I do. I want him here so bad that I want him to die as soon as possible so we can get here quicker. If I prop him up, I can keep him alive for years in desperation. I don't want to do that. He drank at 11 years sobriety. His sponsor had done something that he didn't much like, and he got a little resentment toward his sponsor, and then his sponsor died before he got it cleared up. And he drank. His sponsor was his higher power. Of course he drank. And he had a low-grade resentment that really made him mad. How dare he die before I get it straightened out? And he drank. And he kept drinking and kept drinking. He finally got to me several years later. And we kind of looked at his life. He was a holistic chiropractor. Now I want to show you how God works. I went to one once because of the neuropathy. We're looking at, I've got chronic pain and I get tired of it sometimes. And we're just looking at solutions, and they wanted me to take some adrenal cortex compound. It sounded like a good thing until I read the label. 80% alcohol. And I looked at all the rest of their little remedies. 80% alcohol. That's the base. So that's out for me. So he and I discovered something as we chatted. He was taking his own medications for certain problems he had. The reason he couldn't stop drinking is that he never stopped drinking. Okay. And then pretty soon he'd go to drinking. But he'd been drinking the whole time. Didn't even know it. And the craving was on him. Anyway, we got all that done. He called me. We had a good third step. He was getting ready to write inventory. He was actually getting started. Had a list made and got a couple columns written. Then disappeared and right after Christmas called me and said, I drank over the holidays. What should I do now? And I pray when I get questions like that. I don't know what to say. There's no rules on that. What does he need? And I prayed, and I heard myself say to him this, go drink. Drink until you understand that you cannot not drink. Then call me back. And he's called me once, but he was drinking. He hasn't discovered yet that he can't not drink. Sounds harsh. But I'm there. I'm ready. Any time he calls, I'm ready. But until he comes to that, he hasn't conceded to his innermost self that he can't, that he's alcoholic. What can I do for him? Nothing. And I don't want to spoil a future opportunity. When the time comes that he finds that, he will call me because he can trust me enough to call me and we'll go to work. He may die before then. I don't know. I do know that I can kill him if I just keep putting up with him. Okay. Don't take that as a rule. There are other guys that I just nurse and nurse and nurse. I nursed Chuck for over a year before we got anything done. He was so badly wounded, that's what he needed. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right now. Find him. Right here, right now. If you'll get right here, right now, you will find him. Because that's where he exists. And he's everything. Okay? And you probably won't fall in your chair. At one third step, we did have an epileptic seizure. But I think that would have happened anyway. This was a rather uptight person that was getting ready to do it anyhow. Just pick that time for dramatic effect. I don't know. Half measures avail us nothing. That's a harsh, harsh piece of truth. Half measures don't get me half sober. Half measures avail me nothing. There's no need to even start this unless you're going to finish it. It's what that says to me. Yeah. Don't even start it unless you're going to finish it. Because this is rigorous. This is not easy. This is really tough stuff we're about. It takes the power of God to get me where I can even look at myself, for goodness sakes. With any kind of honesty. I can't do it alone. I can't get rigorously honest. Then they go through the steps to tell us exactly what we're faced with. And our response is automatic. What an order. I can't go through with that. Making amends looks pretty scary when you're not even sure that you've done anything wrong. After all, it was their fault. One of my favorite things when I'm working with inmates in therapeutic situations is to just ask somebody, who brought you here? The judge, the sheriff, the marshals. And we go through, seldom have I ever had anyone say, oh, I did. But that's where we go. Okay. I won't get through this part because I get tired of this technical stuff and I want to tell more stories. What an order, I can't go through with it. Well, don't be discouraged. No one among us has been able to achieve anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down here are guides to progress. And we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Very important for me to learn that. I thought you go from sick bad guy to spiritual fine guy. And it's all, dip. Then I'd get my little wool coat with the leather patches on the elbow, my little place up near Evergreen at the side of Lookout Mountain. And I would listen to Mozart and Beethoven during the day out on the patio I had just outside the French doors and dispense a little wisdom to the peasants as they passed by. Mm-hmm. Beloved by all. Oh, the crap we think of. Okay. Our description of the alcoholic, which we have spent quite some time describing, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. One, we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. Second, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And third, that God could and would if he were sought. Now the time to get off the train or to go back when I'm working with people and see what we missed, because the next thing says, being convinced we were at step three. If we are not convinced of those three propositions, we need to spend some more time getting convinced. Are you all convinced? Can you run your own life?
Not while drinking.
Can you not drink? Can you run your own life?
No.
Not while drinking. Which is, by the way, what you do best, right?
I'm sorry.
Is that what you do best, drinking?
No.
No. Is that what you do most?
No, but I do it really well.
You do it really well. Do you ever do it when you don't want to?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Okay. That's good enough for a start. That's good. Do you think you can stop by yourself?
Actually, I tried once. I went 10 months.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's a good stretch.
But I had to live out in the woods, and
I didn't actually see anything. Following my peyote vision, I lived in the woods for 4 months. That's the only way I could do it, too. The minute I got to San Francisco, I got drunk. Yeah. No wonder I like you. I'll manage my life. I'll go live with the animals. You think you're alcoholic?
Yes.
Can you manage your own life?
Not today.
Not today. Well, this is the only one you got. Do you think any of us can relieve your alcoholism?
Relieve it for me? No.
No, good. He's not filled with illusion. You're right, we can't. Alone or collectively, we can't. The next proposition is the one, are you convinced that God could and would if he were sought?
I'm sorry?
God could and would if he were sought?
Yeah, that's the more difficult part of the process, I think.
Well, it doesn't say found.
Excuse me?
It doesn't say found. It does not say God was found. It says he'll relieve it in the seeking. Are you willing to seek?
Yes, that's why I'm here.
Good. Good. That's a straight answer. Good. He's yours now, Brian. He's yours now. Oh, you poor thing. No, we can move forward. We're now at step three. I'm willing to seek. I understand I can't do it, and I understand you can't do it. So I'm willing to seek deep within myself. See if I can find a power greater than myself within myself that can relieve my alcoholism. If that's what you want, then we're at step three. It's no more complicated than that. Oh, I wish I lived here. I'd really like to sponsor you, but I don't. So I'm going to turn you over to Adolf over here. No, actually, we're making some fun of that. Brian's the one that found him. Right? On the street. Oh, right on the street in Camden. Brian found him.
My first meeting was the night before that.
Is that right?
It was the day, 2 days before that.
No wonder he looks so scared when we walked up to you. It's them. They've been following me all over town. Oh, you're dear to my heart. 6 years ago, it was Jim.
Yeah.
Same place. Wild eyes. Totally psycho. Thank you for letting me love you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, being convinced, we're step three. Which is we've decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. So what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Then Bill goes through this wonderful thing about the actor, which really pulled my chain, because that's me. Have any of you run through this piece before? Briefly, as we make this approach, and this is particularly pertinent. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Are we convinced of that? Okay. Our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. We must be rid of this selfishness. If we don't, it kills us. Okay. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's help. I can't do it, you can't do it. I can't use self to get rid of self. Can't solve the problem with the problem. Neither could we wish, reduce our self-centeredness by wishing it away. We had to have God's help. He gives us a couple ideas about images for God. God the Father, we're his agents, and all that sort of thing. I had a little trouble with the Father thing, but I had time to run that through. My sponsor encouraged prayerful contemplation as well as meditation. In here, there's an admonition that don't let your prejudices deter you from asking what spiritual terms mean to you. And I realize most of them don't mean a thing to me. I've been stealing them all my life. But what does this mean? Father, why am I so upset with my dad? Because my dad was truly a lovely man. He was not perfect, but he was a good man. He was there all the time. He provided for the family. He taught us things. He exposed us to life. He'd pull us out of school sometimes because he thought we'd learn more where we were going than we would in school. And we'd take our lessons with us and we'd go to Carlsbad or somewhere where we had an experience. He was fun. He was playful. He was a musician. One day he came out, a bunch of us were getting tricky with our bicycles. My dad came out and just as a lark, got on it backwards, sat on the handlebars facing the wrong directions, and rode off. Incredible. But I was pissed at him. And I've discovered why in that quietness of my own heart. I know deep within me is the fundamental idea. I know what father means, not as a gender thing, but as a principle. God the Father, I know what that is. And my dad didn't match up. No human being can. I'm asking things of him that are beyond his ability to give me. I was pissed because he didn't give me what I needed at 5. Well, nobody could have, for goodness sakes. I was a demanding little shit. Plus the fact that I'm no longer 5 and I don't need that anymore anyway. Got to get off his back. A number of things occurred. But mainly, I knew what the truth was and he didn't match it. Shame on me. My dad and grandpa were the head of the Colorado Ku Klux Klan in the late 20s and early 30s. So we had some funky ideas in our house for a while. And they both awakened spiritually and spent the rest of their lives straightening that up. They took their robes off somewhere in the 30s. I left their robes on them for years after that. That's what we do. And that's some of the truth that came out of just this basic idea. Okay. That he had done the very best he could with what he had. As far as I was concerned, that wasn't enough. That doesn't matter. He'd done the best he could. And so had I. At least mine was there all the time. I'm in a penitentiary cell and my kids are in a foster home. Maybe I ought to get off his back inside me. And getting off his back got me off of my back. I've done the very best I could and this is where I am. Maybe I better try something new. Because my way doesn't work. It's a wonderful little thing. And we're his children. Didn't know it then, but what a lovely idea that is. Think about that. What is it that children are supposed to do most of the time? Play. And we take it so seriously. Play and sleep and eat. Well, if I'm one of God's children, maybe I need to learn how to play. And I have. I really have learned how to play. And you know where I learned it? Children. Adults don't know how to play. See, they've forgotten. One of the guys I sponsor, brilliant, brilliant man. He's now a millionaire. We don't hear much from him because he's out there somewhere. But when we got, he's the one that gave me a, after 10 hours of listening to his fifth step, I'm dying. He's just, the juice is gone. And I said, man, we got to stop. So I climbed up on his bed and went to sleep. Woke up 2 hours later and he's still going at it. He put a long 10th step on my answering machine once. I wasn't there. He didn't care. But he came to me one day and he said, sadly, he said, I need to have you teach me how to play. I don't know how to play. Dad never showed me. I had no brothers. I've been serious my whole life. Would you show me how to play? So we took him up to Estes Park and took him go-kart riding to start with. That's where boys ought to start, on a go-kart with a governor on it so nobody can get hurt. What he didn't know is that we'd made arrangements, because we did the roof on this place, that if one of us asked, they'd take the governor off our cart. But we had a lot of fun. We began to learn to play. Took him fishing. Took him skiing with me. I didn't go skiing for the first time. Well, the second time. First time I went skiing, I was 16. Some kid fell down right next to me and I heard his leg go snap. And I went and rode toboggans the rest of the day and didn't go back till I was 50. So I'm a recreational skier. I really like green slopes. If there's a mogul on it, I don't want to see it. I just like to, you know, I'm the one that the first three times up was embarrassed because some tiny little voice would go, on your left, and some tiny little kid would go shooshing by me, on your right. I fell down once, and this little creature about so big said, you all right, mister? But I've only fallen a couple times. I don't like falling. My kids took me up there and taught me to ski. They took me to the very top. They said, Pop, there's only one way down. And then throughout the day, each one of them would trade off hanging with me while I learned how to get down off of that mountain. And they told me, use your fear. I'm afraid I'm going to fall. Well, that's what skiing is. It's falling down a mountain. It's just that you control the fall. But you are falling. Make no mistake about it. And if you don't control it, you're going to run into a tree or another skier or something. Anyway, I learned to ski. But I'm a recreational skier. Paul got serious about skiing. and he stopped playing. He started doing mogul jumps and all this shit, and I lost him as a playmate. So I had to go find me another one. I've got one now that's a fishing buddy. He's a former, he worked for the Parks Department in Colorado. And he knows all the good fishing holes. And I'm letting him teach me how to fish. It's like playing cribbage. Just show me where it is. I know how to get it. We're children. Children live with a sense of awe. And so do I. The longer I live with a sense of the presence of God in my life, and the more I do spiritual things, the more in awe I am, because the less I know. This is an incredible... We spent a good part of Thursday just sitting on Brian's porch. Brian is such a kind man. He let me sit on his porch. Just looking at Maine. Do you know how stunning the place is where you live? You have water. Lots of water. And green trees and rolling hills, and the earth smells, and I'm stunned by your state. I will go back to mine because that's where I belong. But I sure did enjoy this one. I'm in awe. How can all this be going on here? And I want to develop that sense more and more and more. Part of why I can talk to you is that you know I'm not talking down to you. I know you're scared. I know you're nervous. I know you're baffled. And so am I. And you know that. And we'll get through this thing together. Yeah. And so we develop that trust. Because I'm not an adult. I don't know anything he doesn't know. But I know him and he knows me. And we both have to go to Dad one. Let me tell you one thing, we'll jump. Do you want to take the third step now, or you want to do it later this evening? It'll help me time it. Okay. I want to tell you one last hang-up I had to get rid of. My first sponsor became a Talking in Tongues reborn Christian. My two best friends on the street and my first street sponsor became reborn Talking in Tongues Christians. I made myself available to the experience, and it just hasn't happened for me. And I went through a period of time where I thought, there must be something wrong with me. And one of my best friends made that same shift. So I started Bible studies, and I followed Dick Grant around and would ask him questions. And I truly made myself available. It just didn't happen that way to me. Well, Jim Ellis and I were doing Bible studies, and Jim stopped at the sixth week we got together. He says, we're going to stop this. I have come to understand that you love Jesus as much as I do. And I don't want to fool with that. Didn't know what that meant, but I took his word for it. Before I got unconfused, a very dear friend of mine, truly spiritual woman. This woman is on a mission for God and has been for years. That manifests this way. There was a time she had work to do, so she couldn't work, and she had no money, and she had no gas in her car, but she drove it for 4 months anyway. People would put a rag in, nothing in there. I don't pretend to understand it. I just know she had a mission to take care of, and she had transportation. Anyway, I was talking to her about this, and whether it's Jesus or Buddha or whatever it is, that last piece, I told her how confused I was, and how willing I was, and what am I doing wrong? She says, nothing. She says, understand this, and this was a Christian woman. She says, I love Jesus dearly, but there are times when I have to go to him and say, Jesus, honey, I really love you, but I need to talk to Dad. And it was consistent with the experience I'd had and put some words on it and freed me up from that. So whatever it may be, there's freedom in the way we do this. I suggest that you consider this as a viewpoint. In all spiritual activities, there are some similarities, religious ceremonies or whatever. The first thing that occurs is an invocation, which means somebody invokes the name of God. they acknowledge the presence of God. I'm disturbed by some things I see in AA today where I hear some chairperson say, let's invite God in. Hey, he's already here. You don't need to do that. I need to acknowledge the presence. If I wanted to talk to Jack, I'll say, Jack. And that isn't a demand for his attention. That's my recognition that Jack is here and I am now ready to communicate if you have time. It's an invocation. Speak the name out loud. Speak the word. Then there is a prayerful ceremony where we say what it is we're here for. What are we going to do? What's this activity about? Then we do whatever that is. And at the end of all that, there's an amen, which closes that spiritual activity and we go on to something else. So I look here to see, does that fit here? And it certainly does. Here at the third step, the first thing it says is God. Okay. I'm acknowledging the presence of God. I'm about to talk to it. Then I ask what I'm here for. I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Take away my difficulties. There's something I ask for. And then I look for the amen and it ain't there. And I go on through looking some more and there's some stuff about inventory and house cleaning and willingness. There's all kinds of things. And then there's another prayer that looks kind of like this one, only it seems to have teeth in it. We call it the seven-step prayer. I'm ready now, you can have all of me. And at the end of that one is an amen. So I have concluded and act as if everything from the Word God here on page 63 to the amen at the end of the seven-step prayer is all part of the same prayer. Prayer now becomes action and activity, and I'm involved in it. It becomes a living thing. It's not just something in my head. Which also means that during this activity, I am spiritually protected. I have the aid of God. I offer myself to thee, take away my difficulties. Well, that's what the inventory helps me do. Relieve me of the bondage of self. That's what the house cleaning helps me to do. That's a viewpoint that I offer you. Those who have done it that way with me, and I didn't do it that way the first time. This has come to me since. Have been 100% successful. Because they've been able to go into the deep, dark places of the mind without fear because they're going in with light. And they trust in their God and they trust that this will actually occur. So, with that in mind, we're going to eat at 6. Looks like you started already, Dave. I love him too, but I haven't had a chance to pick on him yet this weekend.
Jack and I have been picking on you.
Oh, well, that's all right. I need that. So if you wish, then we will say the third step prayer, and then we'll take a nice long break and have a lobster pig out. If you would like, we can get back together later this evening, or if you would prefer, we can do it in the morning. What's your choice? I don't mind. Okay. We're going to eat at 6. What time are we going to get back together? 7:30, 8? What's your play here?
What's your play?
8 o'clock, because I've been to this lobster pig out before. It's going to take till damn near 8 just to wash up. Let's say till 8 o'clock. So we'll take this third step prayer now, then, if you wish. I'm ready. She's ready. If you're ready, join us. If you're not ready, it doesn't matter. God. I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Amen. We'll see you at 8 or before. Absolutely. My experience of that third step with the group has always been very gentle. Did you find that pleasant? That's one of the consistent experiences that I have in the spiritual realm, is it's pleasant. There's a gentleness and a kindness about it. Tell you what, I'm disposed this evening to just sit and chat. We've got a lot of technical stuff to do, and I'm tired of technical for the moment. We'll do it if that's what you wish. But I'd rather just chat and visit and see, because we're going to be here in the morning too. And this is not the definitive big book study of all time. We have now entered into the realm of the Spirit. And so I would just like myself to make myself available to you at this moment, particularly to you newer people, whoever you may be. Because having just entered the world of the Spirit, what's it feel like to you at the moment?
At the moment?
Yeah.
Intense.
That's a good word. It's intense. Pleasantly intense for me.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a different experience, isn't it?
Welcome.
Huh?
A welcome
experience. Yeah. Yeah, I expect so. Well, I'll tell you a couple of stories about that third experience with groups while you figure out what we're going to do next. I dearly love the Santa Monica bunch at the retreat center up in Santa Barbara because they are consistently loony. They're also lovely, lovely people. And at one of those, we had a long discussion as we led up into the third step. We were a couple hours kind of getting there. And I let them run and have their heads so we could make the decision. We'd had a couple times before that, and what was coming out of the group was a certain fanatic, ungentle, but intense, big book AA. And everything had to be just right. And so everybody had to be really ready to take this. After about 2 hours, we said the third step prayer together. And as soon as we got up, two of the people said, well, that didn't count because I didn't really mean it. I thought, well, okay. So we played for another hour. And we took a break and came back, and I said, I'm going out in the garden and say the third step prayer, and if any of you'd like to come join me, do. And it was all over. They all came. It was done. But the most powerful one I've ever experienced was the very first one. This particular monastery or retreat center has a silence rule. It's just the rules of the house. From 10 o'clock at night until after breakfast in the morning, no talking to anybody for any reason whatsoever. Just silence. And I couldn't have timed it if I had tried, but on Saturday night, just before 10, the group reached the third step prayer. We spent a half hour deciding whether to sit, stand, kneel, you know. Finally, everybody knelt, except one guy. He wouldn't kneel for anybody. Didn't matter. Just as we finished the prayer, the bell rang. Nobody could even get up and say, "Wow." They'd take that into silence all night with them. And what an incredible experience, because these are alcoholics. And they were up most of the night learning new ways to communicate without talking. You know, meet in the hall, and it was wonderful to watch it. And the brothers loved it. And the group learned some really important things about communication. There are other ways. And sometimes it's good just to go into the silence. Had one occasion in North Carolina when we came to the third step as a group. One fellow said, "This is an intensely private and personal thing for me, and I would rather not join the group." And he stood outside the group and did his own thing. It didn't mess with the energy in the room at all. It really didn't matter. And what I'm trying to say is that I like to submit to the conditions the big book laid down. Just do it the way it says. But there is no right way. There's no way to judge. This is a spiritual activity and will occur when it's time for it to occur, no sooner, no later. And all I have to do is submit to it. And that's a word we don't like, you know, submit. Bob White gave us that. He said, "All we really do here is comply with the conditions." That's all we have to do, comply with the conditions. And the conditions are set forth here. For this experience, if you want a different experience, you do something different. That's all. Bob said, "The last real decision that I ever made was the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And from that point on, all I've had to do is make the choice between whether I like red or green best. And open my mind." I'm talking to you briefly about the people that had profound effect on my life. I come from the brand of AA where it was expected that you have a profound effect on everybody the minute you meet him. David's down in Texas. That's still talked about. We should 12-step each other every time we meet. Not just a quick, "How are you?" but a genuine, "How are you?" And none of this, "Oh, how are you really? I'll hurt you." Did you meet Bob, David? Did you know Bob? I have a letter from Bob White was one of the early giants of Alcoholics Anonymous. This man's influence has been felt widespread. Gentle, big old Texan. Call everybody Sugar. He grabbed me one time after a little talk down at Lake Whitney. Big, tall fella. Grabbed me by the shoulders and looked in my eyes. And he said, "Sugar, you are a pure D wonder." And I knew at the moment I really was, because Bob said so. I have a letter from the Denver, one of the early Denver groups, 1946. A letter written by one of their members to a group in Colorado Springs, apologizing for Bob's behavior as he passed out of town. It seems that the Denver group had a meeting with Bob about Bob. And it was decided that he was no longer an AA member. And it was charged because of conduct unbecoming a member of the Alcoholics Anonymous. You haven't lived very long, have you? And expressing the hope that their meetings would now be much more peaceful. And apologizing for Mort Robbins, because as Bob left town, he stopped by their group and invited several of the members out for a drink. And later he became one of the finest and most influential AA members ever, just because he was sweet. When he called you sugar, you knew you really were. Bob talked about his initial call. Bob was a bad drunk. And he ended up in a shack out in the middle of West Texas. Something like 350 miles from the nearest help. And three guys from a group in Dallas, I guess it was, somewhere up in there, traveled that entire distance because they had heard he was out there. He didn't call anybody. They knew about Bob, and they knew he was out there, and they knew he was dying. And he said all he can remember for several days was he'd come out of his coma, and somebody would be sitting there with him, and all they'd say is, "We understand, Bob. We understand." And that's all he did. What he remembers is that they were there. Didn't have a drink from that point on. Struggled. So we learn from that about our heritage. Any group of people that doesn't remember its heritage probably doesn't have much of a future either. They will get inventive. Man, this is the last place we ever want to get inventive. Wesley Parrish was another one of the old giants. By the way, any social movement needs giants at the beginning. These are extraordinary people who are set apart, have great personal power and mammoth egos. And they're needed because they're starting a social movement and they just need to move stuff. And they face incredible odds. In God's hands, those egos are just fine. But they all had them. Then a social movement, and we are one, no longer needs giants. We reach a point where we need leaders. No more giants. We need leaders now. People who are of the movement and are willing to lead. And Bill describes those kind of people as the kind of people, AA leaders are the kind of people who can put plans and ideas into action in such a way that the rest of us want to support them and help them. Because most of their ideas came from listening to us, so we can support them, and they're presented well. And we're in that time now. We need strong leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are bordering on the permissive. Instead of open, we're beginning to be permissive, which will lead to disillusion. Because permissive is unprincipled. We don't want to close the doors to anybody who really needs help. But there's, without something going on that's real, a real message that can hold these people, it's just permissive. You've been to some of those meetings. I actually heard a kid, he was profane and talking garbage. And an old member stopped him. And he said, "Just shut up, old man. This is AA. I can talk about anything I want to." And he got that idea from us, you know. But old Wes Parrish was one of the giants. Wes was probably the second homeliest man I've ever seen in my life. About 280 pounds, 4'6" in every direction, bald, big ears, and eyes that would make you just fall in love. And a silver-tongued devil was Wes Parrish. Did you meet Wes?
No.
Oh, man. I figured David knew everybody. Wes touched my heart at depth in a talk he gave one time where he described his first participation in spiritual things. He was unable to grasp any of that early on. And he was struggling, but he wanted to stay sober. He'd been a fisherman on the high seas. He'd done a number of things. He really wanted to stay sober. He was in AA. He wasn't identifying much. But he heard a lady one time give a talk, and it was a spiritual talk, and something clicked in him, and he knew she had something he needed and wanted. So he called her and asked if he could come over. And he went over, and she was out in the kitchen cooking. And she said, Wes, just wait there in the living room for a minute. I'll be through here in just a minute. And he went in and waited, and he set up on the wall was that great, huge painting, that lovely painting of the fisherman guiding his boat in a gale. And the great master is standing behind him with a calm look on his face and his hand on his shoulder. Wes called it the Prince of Peace. He said he's looking at that, and he'd been in gales. And both of them had a look of utter peace and tranquility in the midst of all this chaos. And he said something hit him. He never did talk to the lady. He was driving a little delivery truck, a little one-seat delivery truck. He said he got a little old empty apple crate and put it in the seat next to him, or the space next to him. That was where the Prince of Peace would sit. As he drove around town, he talked to him about everything he'd never been able to talk to anybody about. And began to have his awakening. Of course, then he found out he talked to everybody in the world. But those are the kind of things that stirred my soul at the beginning. Here were real people, worldly indeed, who talked in depth about talking to the Prince of Peace on an apple crate. I can get that. I can't get Solemn High Mass. I don't get it. I'm not there with it. I love it, but I don't have the interaction. I didn't do it. I want to be like them. These were men, and I know you've met some. They were a kind of people that when they walked into a room, things changed. They didn't have to say anything. They'd walk in and things would change. And it was generally the room would get peaceful. Because these men were peaceful. That's who they were. They were at peace. And that's what they brought into the room with them. And the room responded to that. I know we've all met angry people. When they walk in, the whole room changes. Yeah. And I would like to be one of those. Not for myself, but because I remember how I felt when I first saw these people. And it made me feel, I'm okay. This is a good planet to be on. If this is the kind of beings we can produce. And those aren't thoughts. I can put words on them today. Those are feelings. They touched me at a level beyond the level of words or physical touch. I just knew, sugar, you're a pure D wonder. Has anybody ever done that for you? I've been trying to do it all weekend. Sugar, you are a pure D wonder. Look out for this boy. It's true. Jim Griffin was 26 years sober when I met him, former trustee and a gentle man. Big fella. I don't know why, but the bigger they are, the gentler they seem to get, in my experience. Jim took me on a 12-step call with him one time. Classic thing. It was one of those little houses up in North Platte, Nebraska. Little house behind the house. It was more of a garage converted into a shed and then made into a bedroom. And our prospect was in there, and it was a mess, and there was a bullet hole in the wall, and this guy was classic. He was on the bed because he couldn't even get out to go to the toilet. I mean, he was stunned. And he was just coherent enough that we began to chat with him. And I followed Jim's lead. He kind of made it a chat. And we talked about alcoholism and about ourselves. And we spent an hour or so. And Jim said to me, keep talking to him, I'll be right back. And left. And a few minutes later, came back in with a pint of whiskey. And stopped me and handed the man a bottle of whiskey. And said, "We sure do thank you for letting us come by today. Would you mind if we stop by again someday? We have to go now." I'm shocked. And we get out, and I ask him, "What was this all about?" He said it was pretty clear the man did not want what we had to offer today. And he was getting ready to go into severe DTs and convulsions. And we have no right to take away the only medicine that might keep him alive until morning. We'll get another shot at him. I learned about love and compassion. Yeah. These are the kind of things that have moved me in my AA life. I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm really listening. And then it was Reed Edgar. We are people who normally not mix. Have you noticed? Not even in the bars most of the time. I mean, there's all kinds of people in this room I wouldn't drink with. There's also a lot I would. But you'd have to be good at it to keep up. You young ones wouldn't have a chance. It isn't that I drank more than you spilled, it's just I drank. And when it's time to quit, the hell you say. I have these little yellow tablets here, guaranteed to make this drunk last at least two more days. Yeah. I don't know, some of you could keep up. For about a week. Yeah. You'd make me tired, but I'd never let you know that. Reed used to come down to the penitentiary meeting. And this was a stockbroker type or an advertising man. Three-piece suit with a vest. Very dignified and polished gentleman. And his wife was also the same. These were people that had real, genuine class. And Reed touched me deeply at one point. We had a kid come in from the outside and give probably one of the best AA talks I've ever heard. To this day, I don't remember a word he said, but I know I was moved and touched. But we never saw him again. Reed would come in once a month when it was his turn, regularly. And I came to trust Reed because he was regular. He was demonstrating what I wanted to become. On time, able to keep a commitment, just there. Didn't often talk much except during the break when we just chat with him. And I trusted Reed enough that the chances were pretty good I was not going to get out. I owed the federal government 5 years and it was a parole violation. And I was pretty sure I was going back to the federal penitentiary. And I didn't mind. I was now spiritually awake and I could save some of those poor wretches down there too. You know, the ego still goes to work. I was prepared to go back. I really didn't mind. But there was a chance. And I asked Reed at the last meeting we came to. I said, "Reed, because you guys kept saying, on your first night out, come here. And you'll probably be able to stay out. Don't hang your AA on the gate on the way out. Make a meeting your first night out." And I asked Reed, how do you suppose I'm going to be accepted out there? Because I still didn't feel... You know, I'm a year and a half sober now. I've been through the steps. I've been conducting the 12-step study school. I'm pretty fit, but I don't know how to live out there. How am I going to be accepted? And he said, "Well, why don't you come find out? You come to York Street your first night out, and I'll promise you this. One of us who's been coming down here will be there to meet you." That's a pretty wild promise, because we didn't know when I was going to show up. But see, he knew one of them would. There's always somebody around. Well, my first day out was one of those remarkable...